Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Ruben Nyman, who is the sleep specialist and clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Arizona's Center for Integrative Medicine. Dr. Nyman is the author of several books on sleep and dreams, including Healing Night, Healthy Sleep, The Yoga of Sleep, To Sleep Tonight, and Hush. He regularly blogs about sleep and dreams for the Huffington Post and Psychology Today, and he's going to talk to us today about how and why so many of us are deprived of good quality sleep and dreams, and in what way we might take some steps to redress the balance. Hello, Ruben. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for inviting me.
Could you maybe begin by telling us a bit about your background and how you became involved in this field of work?
Well, I often wonder why everybody isn't either involved or more interested in sleep and dreams. I think it is such a profound, obviously profound part of life. But I think the common misunderstanding of sleep and dreams is really a critical factor in so many of the woes we're challenged with today. But for me, it started in childhood. Both my parents were Holocaust survivors, and had learned a critical lesson about sleep. They'd learned to love sleep because it was really the only respite they had for the years they were in concentration camps. And I think this was related to a little game my mother played with me when I was a boy. She would ask me over and over what was the best thing in life. And although I knew the answer she was looking for, I would provide her with childish responses like toys, games, ice cream, TV. And she would say no, 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 and remind me again that the best thing in life was night and sleep. And as I grew and I came to understand her history better, it made so much sense to me that sleep was a profound opportunity to reconnect with peace, with inner peace, even in the worst of life circumstances. In later years, through my teens, through the psychedelic era in the 60s and early 70s, I became interested in consciousness, more interested in dreaming, and then later in graduate school was introduced to the work of Carl Jung, which I think was the icing on the cake for me.
And so this might be an obvious question, but what is sleep?
You know, it's a great question, Barry. It's a question that too frequently isn't asked. And when it's answered, I think the answers tend to be overly constrained by a scientific view. I think trying to define sleep from a waking consciousness perspective introduces a kind of wake centrism. Not that we shouldn't do that, but we can never fully understand sleep through waking world eyes. We need to remember that sleep is another form of consciousness. Sleep and dreams are the two other essential forms of consciousness. And we need to break out of what I consider a kind of wake centrism. We look at waking the way we used to look at Western culture. We would view and study other cultures through Western eyes. And we need to consider that sleep needs to be understood in its own terms. And I think the best definition that I can offer of what sleep is that sleep is serenity. It's a profound form of peace that I think is graciously offered to us nightly, independent of who we are and what we do. It's not something we have to earn. It's not something we have to deserve. We have to be willing to take it. But I think sleep, normal sleep, naturally brings us back to a default in our consciousness, which is a spaciousness. Paul Valéry, the French philosopher, once said that God made everything out of nothing, and sometimes it shows through. And I think this is very true of sleep, the nothingness, the peace of nothingness, the spaciousness of emptiness, the serenity of that is something that we can access in sleep.
When you say waking life is driven primarily by intention, while night consciousness is primarily informed by receptivity. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I think there's overlap with both, but, you know, we waking world and waking consciousness, how we perceive the world is defined by what we want. So we all have layers and layers and hierarchies of various intentions, from incidental, transient, superficial desires to really profound visions of what we want in life. This is something I pretty regularly ask my patients. And over the years, when I've asked them, what do you really want? What's your intention? The answers have ranged from the obvious of I want to be one with everything to a woman who sat and thought about this for a few long seconds and said, what I really want is a donut. And I think all of those answers are there's validity to them. But what we want, becoming aware of it, we realize that our intention, our motivation determines perception. What I want creates a frame around the world that I look at, and that becomes my world. Motivation determines perception. Perception determines the world I live in. So in waking consciousness, we see it through what I think of as more microscopic analytic eyes that allow us to move forward and to interact with, have a conversation with life. And in contrast to that, although there's some intention evident in dream life, of course, but night consciousness, which includes sleep and dreams, is defined primarily by reception. There's an openness. There's an openness to a mysterious conversation, a dance we do with life. And I think both are necessary, but I think we have lost a sense of balance, a sense of parity between these two approaches because we so devalue night consciousness. In fact, most of our perspectives of sleep and dream today are utilitarian. You know, we have all these arguments about why we should sleep and why we should dream. And most of them take the form of, you know, sleeping and dreaming make us better waking people. There's no doubt that they do. It's unquestionable. But looking at sleep and dream solely as being secondary and subservient to servants of waking life really limits our experience of them. It confines dreaming to this sort of, you know, sometimes sort of like a funhouse mirror thing we look at. It's a game, a parlor game we play. We try to decode it so that we can juice it and obtain information about the depths of our psyche that we can use in the waking life. And we look at sleep, again, as something that's just a restoration, a recharging of batteries, for example, so that we're better at waking. And once again, I think sleeping and dreaming are profound substructures, if you will. They support waking life, but there's also something else there. They're open doors, they're avenues, they're vistas into a much broader, I think, deeper and richer experience of life.
You mentioned Jung as an inspiration earlier. How is sleep different, say, from his interpretation of the unconscious and also the unconscious that we enter via medication?
Well, I think Jung's focus was largely on remapping the unconscious, and I think he broke through this notion that the unconscious that Freud saw, which was an unconscious that was simply there to serve waking life. For Jung, it was a whole new territory. Now, Freud said that dreams were the royal road to the unconscious. I think from the Jungian perspective, dreams are the actual territory. So I think Jung came at it with a lot more humility and a lot more regard. And I think that foundation, of course, there's been so much more work done in our typical views, really has opened the possibility for us to have a different kind of relationship with the dream world.
You also take a somewhat Jungian perspective on darkness and many people's fear of it in an archetypal way.
Yeah. Jung, of course, introduced the notion of shadow to the Western world. And I've come to believe that even as adults, many of us are really afraid of the dark. And it's not darkness per se that we're frightened of, but it's what we can see in darkness. There are certain things that become visible only in a darkened context. You know, the human retina is actually sensitive enough to detect the presence of a single photon, but that can only happen, of course, if we are in a pitch black place. So there are things, we can see stars, for example. The glory of the night sky is only visible in darkness. Even though the stars are present during waking hours, they're occluded by the brightness of waking life, by the brightness of waking consciousness. So Jung's notion of shadow, I think, is very critical. If we want to enter into an open-hearted conversation with the dream world, we need to understand that there will be some very challenging images. I do a lot of work with people around nightmares, around bad dreams. And in our world, particularly today in the U.S., the posture toward the nightmare is that it is a form of psychopathology. It's a sign of disease. And of course, we have tens of thousands of wounded warriors returning from fronts, war fronts in Afghanistan, Iraq, and many of these folks return with severe PTSD associated with horrific nightmares. And the primary response to those large, intense, dark dreams is to drown them out with medication. This is mostly what happens. I believe, and I think many dream specialists today believe, that dreaming is healing. There's strong evidence for that. And even a bad dream can provide healing. So we've lost our regard for the endogenous healing function of dreams. And I think there's a whole other way of approaching both dreams and nightmares. And that's it's more of a social perspective. Again, Jung's work on archetypes, which suggests that there are levels, there are deeper, or if you will, higher levels of dreaming where we enter a shared dream world. I think this is profoundly important today. We need to recognize, for example, that the nightmares that come home to us from the war front, and I would say even nightmares from other sources, they don't just belong to the individual. They're not just a sign of trauma or depression. I think they belong to all of us, and we've all contributed to their occurrence. And I think it really, I would say, it takes a village, it takes a community approach to heal a nightmare.
Okay, yeah. You also have concerns about not just medicating for nightmares, but for other sleep conditions such as insomnia, don't you?
I do. I think, getting back to a question you asked earlier, there is a difference between the natural unconsciousness, the deeper parts of consciousness, and we use the term often unconscious to refer to people being knocked out. That defines the unconscious as not being conscious, not being awake or aware. But we've come to believe, I think, that we can actually recreate the natural unconsciousness that is present in sleep and dreams with medication, with chemicals. And there's no evidence for that. And there's growing data suggesting that we are truly harming ourselves with these indulgences in medications. And from a dream perspective, my single greatest concern today in the world is that we have lost sight of the dreamscape. There's an uncanny parallel around the globe between our relationship to the environment, the global environment, our looking at the world, at all of its resources as something we can simply use, we can extract, and we can juice them and use them. There's a parallel between that and how we look at the dream. And I think in the same way that we've polluted our environment, we've polluted the dreamscape. My big concern is that we are significantly more dream deprived than we are sleep deprived. With all of the media attention to sleep deprivation, I think it's now in the collective consciousness that this is an issue, and it is. But so many of the negative medical and psychological ramifications we attribute to sleep loss actually result from dream loss. If you look at the way we live, common lifestyle today, excessive alcohol consumption, excessive reliance on drugs like antidepressants, anticholinergic agents, benzodiazepines, anti-anxiety agents, all of these drugs and many others also suppress REM sleep. So we're tamping down, we're sort of constricting and shutting down the channels through which the dream comes to us. And, you know, there's an unspoken epidemic in the world today, and that's the epidemic of constipation. It's a huge problem. And I think, again, there's a parallel between stopping up of our natural digestive processes and stopping up this constipation of the flow of dream material. And I really believe that the single most critical overlooked factor in the world epidemic, the growing epidemic of clinical depression, is the fact that we've damaged and suppressed our dreaming.
Well, what are dreams then, Ruben? And why are they, you know, so important for our well-being? Why do we have them?
Well, I think that, before I can answer that, I want to go back a step. Yeah. In my work, I'm developing what I call a 3D perspective of dreams. It's looking at dreaming from three separate perspectives. One of them is a scientific perspective, and from science, we look at the dream as REM sleep, and there's a lot of really interesting information, interesting things we've learned about REM sleep. REM sleep is the neurophysiology, the substrate in the brain of what goes on in dreaming. That's one perspective. Incidentally, most of the scientists that I know that study REM sleep believe that dreams are totally meaningless. They look at REM as a functional neurological process. So that's one avenue of study of the dream is REM sleep. It's a body, biological focused study. The second one is a mind or psychological focused approach to the dream, which is the psychological, the archetypal perspective. In contrast to REM sleep, it's a look at the personal experience of the dream, the subjective phenomenological dream, the dreams you and I have at night. And of course, there's a whole literature and interest in understanding and interpreting that dream, the subjective. So we have the objective and the subjective. We have REM sleep and the dream. And the third dimension in this model is what I call dreaming. And the notion of dreaming actually has roots in shamanic and indigenous traditions around the world. It says that dreaming, although it may appear most clearly during nightly periods of REM, it says that dreaming goes on all the time. I think of dreaming as a way of seeing, in contrast to those waking world microscopic analytic eyes that we're so accustomed to wearing. The dream eyes, and what I think of as dream eyesight, is macrospheric. It's a wide-angle lens. It's just casting this openness in our perception of life, and we begin to see the periphery, the context. We begin to see the edges of it all, and it casts it in a whole new way. So dreaming would include shamanic practices. It would include what Jung and archetypal psychologists call the waking dream. And when we bring all three of those together, I think we begin to come closer to a sense of what dreaming is. And one of the conclusions it's brought me to is that there is a continuity between dreaming and waking. In fact, I've come to believe that waking itself is a kind of dream. It's a dream that has been that results from a much tighter, more focused, analytic view of the experience of life. Again, when we relax that view, we notice a continuity. When we dream, when we're in REM sleep, for example, there is very limited sensory input. You know, we're not seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and there is virtually no motor output. Because when we sleep, and particularly when we dream, we lose our capacity to process information from the physical world around us, and we lose our ability to respond to that. So there's nothing going in. Sensory-wise, there's nothing going out. And how I look at that is that we become disembodied when we dream. It's parallel to many cultures that say that when we dream, the soul leaves the body. In contrast, when we're awake, consciousness is defined. What we experience is shaped and framed and constrained and channeled by sensory input, the things we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and so on, and also by motor output, the way we respond physically, you know, with our bodies. It's a little bit like if you think of consciousness as a fluid, as this watery liquid, when water runs through the waking world landscape, it carves a stream or a creek or a river. It carves banks, and those banks channel the flow of that watery consciousness. That is a picture of waking life. The banks are defined by sensation and motor responses. the dream life, that watery consciousness then flows into the sea. It opens up. And I think that's a metaphor that gives us a sense of the dream. So this continuity, this connectedness in our consciousness, this oneness in our consciousness is so critical. In fact, the word consciousness has no plural.
So would you say, rather than the traditional view of waking and sleeping as being two dichotomous states, they're more on a sort of spectrum in a way?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we segregate them. When I spoke about all the ways we tend to suppress and inhibit dreaming, it creates a barrier. It dams up that river. It doesn't allow the flow of waking consciousness to connect with a larger sea of consciousness, which is more of a collective, if you will. I think recognizing that oneness is also at the heart of many spiritual practices. Mindfulness practices, for example, that allow us without judgment to open to deeper experiences, both experiences in the body and in the mind. But I think this is really what we're all looking for, is that sense of oneness.
Yeah. So from what you said, it seems clear why so many people have difficulty sleeping and dreaming. But why do you think so little progress has been made?
Well, some of that difficulty, there's not good data on this, but most sleep specialists will tell you, and I've encountered this day in and day out, that one of the reasons people don't sleep well is that they are resistant to their dreams. And we see this in Shakespeare's Hamlet, in that classic soliloquy line, "To sleep, perchance, to dream." There's currently a very popular English singer-songwriter who goes by the name Passenger, who has a beautiful song with poetic lyrics about the things that stop us dreaming. It's a beautiful insight that when we can't get what we need, we often will stop our dreams, because our dreams will push us toward that. So I think a lot of sleep difficulty is associated with a resistance to letting go into mystery, letting go of waking consciousness, of the ego that drives waking life for most of us, and allowing the flow of our waking consciousness, that stream, to really reunite, flow back into dreams. But the other side of this is that our obsession, I would say, with waking life, our belief that waking is the premium in consciousness of all that is, I think it tethers us to the waking world. And we can't use waking to leverage our way into sleep. The waking mind, the thinking mind, the analytic mind, can try to understand sleep conceptually, but it can't get us into it. This is like studying swimming by sitting on the side of the swimming pool. So the other piece of this, and I think the real critical piece in learning to sleep again, is practicing a kind of humility that recognizes that waking isn't all there is, and the willingness to surrender, a willingness to surrender the waking self. The Dalai Lama has said that the psycho-spiritual experience of falling asleep is identical to the psycho-spiritual experience of dying. There's that kind of profound a practice of letting go at the end of the day. And I think it's a very wonderful, spiritually enhancing practice, but many of us have forgotten how to do it and become afraid to do so.
Didn't he also say that sleep is the best form of meditation or something like that?
Yes. I've always wondered if he said it tongue-in-cheek, but I think not, because, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a very challenging, arduous spiritual path is Tibetan sleep and dream yogas. Sleep. I think of sleep as meditation personally. And when my friends brag that they're meditating for an hour and a half every day, I tell them that I practice for 8 hours a night.
Could you just give some brief practical advice to people to perhaps help them improve their quality of their sleep and dreams?
Yes. So getting back to this notion of the continuity of consciousness, dreaming and waking have a continuity, but I think sleep is part of that continuity. I've come to believe that sleep is the default in consciousness. In other words, that we are all always already asleep, that sleep persists very quietly. It's that nothingness in the background. It's always there. And our modern belief that we have to, quote, go to sleep suggests that sleep is in another place in consciousness, and I somehow have to navigate my way there. And that, what that does is it engages the waking mind again and tries to use waking to leverage ourselves back to sleep. But I think just knowing, just considering, remembering what I think of as a deeper truth, that, that sleep is the default in consciousness. It's the foundation. It's always there. We don't have to go to sleep. We simply have to practice letting go of waking. Now, there are some very practical things that would help us do that. And one of them is simply sleeping in dark, or simulating dusk to begin with. You know, most of us are significantly overexposed to light at night, and light suppresses melatonin. It damages the entire circadian sleep and dream rhythm. So being willing to let go of the day is not something you can do in a flash when you turn off the last lamp on your bedstand. It requires a gradual descent. We go into sleep like a sunset. The sun doesn't suddenly set. You know, we have this poetic notion of nightfall, but night never really falls. It only gradually descends. And we need to look at sleep in that way, that it's a gradual descent. So we dim the lights at night. We make sure we sleep in total darkness. Also, what happens when we sleep in dreams, sleep and dream, is there is a critical gradual drop in our core body temperature. In the outer world, in the environment, everywhere on Earth, when the sun goes down, the environmental temperature drops gradually and reaches its lowest point before the dawn, before the sun returns. And there's a beautiful parallel in our own biology. We need to let go of energy to sleep. And that is very palpable in the fact that, that normally when we go to sleep, our body temperature starts to drop and it decreases gradually and it reaches its lowest point just before we wake up. And actually, that's a point where we're doing a lot of dreaming. So, And then it comes back up when we awaken. We need to be willing to release energy, both waking world energy and energy biologically. Many of us consume more energy than we need. Again, there's an uncanny parallel between the energy crisis globally and I think the energy crisis within individuals. You know, globally we're faced with this critical challenge of the planet warming. As Al Gore once said, the planet has a fever. At an individual level, it's striking that tens of millions of us are chronically inflamed. We suffer from chronic inflammation, which is a substrate of all major diseases. I think it's associated with the excessive consumption of energy. Again, we're so obsessed with waking, and waking is mediated by energy. We consume energy in the form of food. Too much of it. We consume energy in the form of excessive light exposure. We consume energy in the form of excessive exposure to information. And I think all of this stirs us up. It literally heats us up. And we get too hot. We take on much more even than we're able to release at night. And for me, this is the primary cause of sleep disorders.
Now, your latest book, Hush, which is a series of short prescriptions about sleep and dreams, ideally perhaps to be read at bedtime, it's a kind of combination of sleep science and that spiritual mystical aspect that you've already spoken about. Now, a wonderful line for me was, "Dreaming provides an essential poetic cushion for our sharply literal lives." Could you expand on that a little bit and just tell us something about the book briefly?
Yeah, you know, what I tried to do in this book was to distill kernels, essential kernels about sleep and dreams. And yes, it's an intentional marriage of a scientific and a depth psychological and spiritual approach. Too many people today who are troubled by sleep believe that they have to become experts in sleep, and they're reading these tomes. And the truth is that many people who've never read a book about sleep, including children and animals, know how to sleep perfectly well. And so this is a book that's not meant to inspire analysis. It's meant to encourage a practice of letting go.
Okay. And what is your understanding of the middle way, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, very much. I think that's a very important question. I think often that this new understanding of sleep and dreams is one that requires a dialogue with life, recognizing that many of us are not on good speaking terms with our own lives. We're just trying to push life around. And for me, the middle way is dialogical. It's conversational. It's approaching in a non-judgmental way all sides of things. And also not using science dogmatically. I see myself as a scientist, but I think we need to understand what science can and cannot do. So I think for me, the middle way is about an open-hearted conversation, a willingness also to deal with ambiguity, to deal with uncertainty, and not try to cap all of that by stretching science.
Okay. And my last question, if people want to find out more about your work, how can they go about it?
The best way would be to begin by accessing my website, which is drnaiman.com. It's drnaiman.com. I have links there, for example, to a lot of writing available on the web. I blog for Huffington Post. I've done some blogging for Psychology Today. So people can begin to access a little more detail on the work through the website. Also, of course, my books. In addition to Hush, my first book, Healing Night, which provides a more comprehensive view on sleep and dreams, I have a series of audiobooks out, one I've done with Dr. Andrew Weil on healthy sleep, the yoga of sleep, and upcoming, hopefully in the near future, I'm now writing a book called Dream Life, A Little Course in Consciousness, and it encompasses much of what we've spoken about today.
Okay, well, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you today, Reuben. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate this very much.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.